This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We have a great show for you today. We're going to talk about the United States sending the USS Abraham Lincoln Carrier Group to the Persian Gulf in response to threats from Iran. The New York Times and other American media outlets are criticizing the move. They say that it's provocative against Iran. But later in the show, we're going to hear a report from trumpet writer Brent Noctegal in Jerusalem giving the facts about what's happening here. Brent was just in the Mediterranean coastal town of Ashkelon in Israel, just north of the Gaza Strip. Just this past Sunday, rockets from Gaza came in as part of several attacks by terrorist groups that received their funding and even their orders from Iran. So as much as the American media want to say that the United States is the provocateur, the facts prove otherwise. And it's quite remarkable that American media would take Iran's side in this situation. At the end of the show, I'm going to talk a bit about why disciplining our children often fails. I'll give you some practical advice for how to reduce the number of battles you're having with your children. But first, we are going to talk about what is happening in American universities.
Go Insider, go Hope! Go Insider, go Hope! Go Insider, go Hope! Go Insider, go Hope!
Our students are our future. The country is mostly run by the university students of the last generation. So if you want to see the direction of the country in the future, look at what we're teaching in our universities. And what you see there is a shocking mess. I want to run through a few recent headlines within the past week or so to get a sense of how steeped in radical leftism our colleges and universities are becoming. But we'll start with this article from May 1st, 2019. This is from the American Institute for Economic Research. The title is, "Here is Proof That the Leftist Tilt on Campus Has Gotten Dramatically Worse." It says, "College professors have long positioned themselves to the political left of the American public. The progressive skew in higher education used to be a stable plurality, though. Then something changed around the year 2001. The percentage of faculty who identify with the political left began to skyrocket. In the course of under 15 years, left-leaning faculty rose to an outright majority of 60% of the professoriate." And this article says this progressive turn is now the new normal in higher education. This report says faculty who identify to the right of center have taken the greatest hit, dropping from 28% in the late 60s and 22% as recently as 1995 to only 12% today. It appears to be driven by a sharp rise in the subset of liberal faculty who identify as far left. And this trend, as strong as it is in the university as a whole, it's really strong in certain fields. This says professors in the humanities and social sciences skew much further to the left than the physical sciences. Over 80% of English professors, for example, identify on the political left. 80% of English professors. And subjects like history, political science, sociology, and fine arts typically approach or exceed 70%. So colleges are getting taken over with teachers of these social sciences, and those social sciences are being taken over by leftists. But the whole political climate on college campuses is lurching left. So students come in politically neutral, they leave politically leftist, and a lot of them are becoming radicalized. One of these recent articles linked to an older article that was on Forbes.com. This is from last July, and this is really stunning. The title of this article is "Diversity and Other Administrative Monstrosities: The Case of the University of Michigan." This is what it says. Mark Perry, an economics professor at the University of Michigan at Flint, And a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute recently calculated that his university has nearly 100 diversity administrators, more than 25 of them earning over $100,000 a year. Collectively, they cost the University of Michigan with fringe benefits about $11 million annually. Adding in other costs such as travel and office space expenses, the total cost rises to perhaps $14 million or $300 for every enrolled student at the U of M in the fall semester 2017. So $14 million to hire to have these 100 diversity administrators at this college. Now, what are these diversity administrators doing? What is their job, really? So many people in universities have made themselves into experts at finding injustice in society, finding racism and bigotry. They find it in society, they find it in history, they find it in their own curriculums, on their own campuses. Everywhere they look, they find evidence of these problems that demonstrate just how important their own jobs are. This is an article that was in the Telegraph on May 1st. The title is, "Universities Must Decolonize the Curriculum to Boost Black Students' Grade," vice chancellors say. So this says, "Universities must decolonize the curriculum in order to help black students close the attainment gap with their white peers," vice chancellors say. "Campuses need to become racially diverse and inclusive environments if black, Asian, and minority ethnic are to succeed academically," according to a new report. What's interesting about this is these are individuals that push to bring more of these students in. They want to increase and advance diversity on college campuses. And what that means is if you're prioritizing, say, ethnic diversity, if you're prioritizing skin color over academic standards, that inevitably results in a lowering of standards, or you end up having students on those campuses that are not equipped to keep up with the academic demands of that school. And so when those students don't perform, well, you can blame the racist curriculum, rather than saying, well, it's a result of our bad policies, or we shouldn't have brought these students in here in the first place. No, the problem is that the curriculum itself is racist. So this article continues, "Universities UK, which represents vice chancellors, commissioned a review into how institutions can ensure more black, Asian, and minority ethnic students graduate with top degrees." They want to make sure that there are enough of the students of these minorities that get the top degrees, not just that they're attending, but we need to ensure equality of outcome. And so how are they doing this? Well, they're consulting with the students. It says institutions should consult with students and, quote, "evaluate where it might be necessary to review courses and assessments to ensure that they are not overly white and Eurocentric," according to this group, Universities UK. So more and more of these cases, the students are considered the authorities, and I'll show you more evidence of that a little later on. The report's recommendation comes amid growing calls to decolonize the curriculum as students urge their professors to examine whether courses are too dominated by white, male, Eurocentric perspectives. Reading lists and course structures in all subjects should be scrutinized to ensure there is no racial bias, according to Baroness Amos, who is director of the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, and the country's first female black university leader. She says, this article says, "SOAS students previously demanded that philosophers such as Plato and Kant are removed from syllabus because they are white." Just the fact that they are white shows they should not be taught at the college. That's what's happening at universities today. So here's a couple of more instances. This is from campusreform.org, March 29th, just a few weeks ago. "Founding fathers under attack. Students demand Thomas Jefferson statue removal." This same thinking is spreading over campuses all over the country. Those other ones from that Telegraph article, it's talking about campuses in the United Kingdom as well. But this says students at Hofstra University protested a statue of Thomas Jefferson on Friday at the second annual event titled "Jefferson Has Gotta Go." The statue has been the center of controversy on the campus and has been defaced with decolonize and Black Lives Matter signs and stickers. It quotes the Hofstra College Democrats president, Bryn Levine, who said, "Yes, the removal of the statue is important, but it's about what the statue represents, a legacy of racism and bigotry on college campuses." This is what Stephen Fleury has been talking about on the Trumpet Daily radio show. Here they are coming after Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, who wrote the creed that the United States is a nation where we recognize the truth that all men are created equal, and that we've strived, and imperfectly, but this has been the what we've strived to live up to as a nation, to bring that kind of equality of opportunity to all people. And it was Thomas Jefferson who wrote that, and he's the one that they're attacking because of his history. Some of it's true and some of it isn't. But this says, the further demands from this group, Jefferson's got to go, stated in its media advisory. They said an online bias reporting system, an online complaint receipt program, and mandated comprehensive cultural competency training. Competency training is what they want. That's very 1984 type language for the kind of propaganda that they want to enforce on students and faculty. And this article says this protest came just hours after George Washington University students voted to ditch the school's mascot, George the Colonial, named after another founding father, George Washington. So they're going after President Washington as well. This is another article. Again, these are all just from the last week or so. This is April 30th from the Times, and it's Cambridge to examine its links to slave trade. The University of Cambridge has announced a 2-year inquiry into its historical links to the slave trade that will explore whether it should pay reparations. The investigation, which is the first of its kind in England and Wales, will look for ways to acknowledge publicly how the university gained from slavery. Glasgow University, which carried out a similar, smaller exercise last year, found that it had benefited to the tune of almost £200 million and would be undertaking a program of reparative justice. It includes creating a center for the study of slavery. So they've found that, well, in their past, according to whoever the scholars were that looked into this, they decided that we owe slaves and their descendants £200 million worth of reparative justice. And this article, this is from another article about the same thing, May 1st, in The Telegraph. The press release about this inquiry, the only available published statement so far, includes the inquiry among the university's race equality initiatives with an apparent response to the current student call for decolonization of the syllabus. The inquiry has been prompted by a roundtable held in February by the Center of African Studies. Its advisory group is heavy with specialists in Africa, but thin on historians. And this makes the point, historical analysis without prior assumptions is likely to challenge any simple assumption that slavery was fundamentally racist. Just talking about some of the factors that they're overlooking as they pursue this very politically charged study. But this Times article gives a couple more examples here. Several leading U.S. universities have had highly charged debates about their links to slavery. 2 years ago, after pressure from students, Yale said that it would rename one of its colleges that had been named after John Calhoun, a U.S. vice president who was an ardent advocate of slavery. Princeton is running a research project into its links with slavery, and Georgetown renamed two buildings that were named after college presidents who sold slaves to pay off campus debts. This says Cambridge, which has endowment reserves of about £1.7 billion, said that two full-time postdoctoral researchers based in the Center of African Studies would look through the university's archives and other records to uncover how the institution might have gained from slavery and the exploitation of labor. St. John's College, Oxford, announced plans to appoint a researcher to examine its own role in colonialism, including monuments, objects, pictures, and buildings owned by the college. This is more and more the all the rage on college campuses. And you notice that the way that these people are going about what they're doing, they're appointing these individuals who are taking a very one-sided view, and they're making very strong demands. And at the same time, you have students making these demands of administrators and faculty while they're defacing statues and demanding resignations and demanding changes to the curriculum within these colleges. And with this shift to the left, you see the rise in some very uncivilized behavior, behavior that is antithetical to the ideals of Western civilization. You see this hatred for history, the hatred for traditions. You see more and more censorship. You see free speech getting shut down. You see universities refusing to allow conservative voices on their campuses. This is another quote from that American Institute for Economic Research article. It said, multiple surveys suggest that students outside of the progressive left self-censor their beliefs on campus, fearing both viewpoint discrimination and bias from faculty in grading. Recent empirical studies of faculty in psychology and law also reveal evidence of actual discrimination against viewpoints that fall outside of the progressive umbrella, particularly in academic hiring. In other words, it's only going to get more and more this way as they use these kinds of criteria to decide who are they going to bring into the colleges. So they talk about justice. They're using the language of justice and freedom and so on. And the left brands itself as advocates of freedom. But wherever you see these views rising, you see the opposite of freedom. More and more you see intimidation. You see bullying. You see unruliness. And mob rule. You see coercion and authoritarianism and tyranny. The same kind of tactics that you've seen by utopianists throughout history, and particularly in the 20th century under more authoritarian regimes. I want to talk about one specific example that gives you a real deep look at what is really going on here. You may have heard of events in recent years at the Evergreen State College. This is a public liberal arts school in Washington State. It's also one of the most leftist colleges in the country. A documentary was recently released about those events by filmmaker Mike Naina. And I want to share some of this with you. And it gives a strong sense of just how radical what is happening in our colleges really is and how far off the rails this movement will go. A few years ago, the president at the school, George Bridges, started a program, he said, to advance diversity on the campus. Now, Brett Weinstein was a biology professor on the campus, and this is him talking about this in this recently released documentary.
There was a faculty meeting with an unusual agenda. The agenda involved the faculty voting to require our union to insert into our contract a provision in which every faculty member would reflect on their own growth relative to their personal racism each and every year in their self-evaluation. There is something preposterous about the idea that we all have this internal racism. And if we had been asked to personally reflect on our own internal racism every year, I still would have been troubled by the fact of the assumption that it was present. But nonetheless, it would not have posed the danger in the institutional context of, here, could you write to us about your own racism every year in your self-evaluation, which then becomes fodder for promotion, for firing, for all sorts of proceedings.
So President Bridges at the college, he created what he called the Equity Council, and this is how he explained it.
I established and charged this equity council, this incredible equity council, with developing a plan for institutional change, systemic change that would enable Evergreen to acknowledge and address the equity gaps that are pervasive on our campus.
So this documentary shows footage of a meeting that this equity council held, and I'd like you to listen to some of what was said at this meeting.
Because it is no longer acceptable that our mission and vision only applies to a few. So as we think about this plan, we should be thinking about how are we unscrewing the screws, and it will take many hands to do this, to unscrew the structure of institutional racism. We have a beginning to do this. And our hope is that we are inviting you to come along. We're going to do it. Don't get it twisted. But we would like for you to join us on this road, on this journey. So we invite you. We want more conversation, and we know there's much more work to be done. We invite that conversation. But if you want to be an obstructionist, work on your own.
In this meeting, one of the organizers had people come to the front of the room and form what he called a canoe. He wanted everybody to get on board with this plan so that it could move forward. So he arranged them in rows. He tried to make this look sort of canoe-like. You can see this on this video. But he said, okay, before we move forward in this canoe, we need the faculty to tell us why we should let you on board. So you'll hear him explain this, and then you're going to hear these white-skinned faculty, including the president of the college, essentially apologizing and saying, well, we'll do whatever needs to be done in order to advance this agenda.
Oh, hold on one second.
Hold on.
The senior administrators, you have to ask for permission and commit some things before boarding the canoe. So can we step back out?
So I would like to board the canoe because I'm committed to enhancing and furthering inclusion and equity in our campus community among both students and staff, faculty, and to do that with compassion and kindness.
Personally, I am committed to making Evergreen a more student-ready campus, and as provost, I am committing resources to help train our faculty be able to promote equity inclusion in the classroom and outside the classroom.
I carry with me the legacy of boarding schools, and I carry with me the legacy of adoption, forced adoption. And I'm here because I refuse to continue to be assimilated. I refuse. And I refuse to let whiteness consume me. And I'm going to say that word explicitly, whiteness. I refuse. I refuse for my mother. I refuse for her mother, for my grandfather, for my ancestors, for my brothers and sisters, my relatives today. I refuse.
I'm here and I commit the position of privilege and power I occupy as the president of this college to invest in this council, its initiatives, and its plans.
So what do you suppose is going to be the outcome of this? I believe it is stunning that people think this will actually lead to more racial harmony. We were talking earlier about all these administrators, these diversity administrators and experts in race relations that are taking over these colleges. I want you to hear one of these diversity administrators. This is an explanation of racism. This is helping people to understand what is racism. In the words of one of these experts, this was a lecture given to Evergreen faculty by Robin DeAngelo, whose title is Scholar of Whiteness Studies. This is what she said.
Structural institutionalized inequality or racism, right? So an anti-racist frame understands racism as a system. While individual players partake in it, it's not dependent on individual players. Right? It's embedded in the fabric of the society, in all the institutions, the norms, the practices, the policies, the way that history is told, and it functions to ensure an unequal distribution of basically everything between people of color as a whole and white people as a whole.
So that's an extraordinary definition of racism. If you are white and you think that you are not racist, you are dead wrong as far as she's concerned. This is what this expert, Robin DeAngelo, has to say to you. If you think that you are not racist, this is what she says about that idea.
I can't emphasize this enough. This is not useful. Just get rid of it. It is not possible to avoid being socialized into a racist worldview if you're white. It's not possible. It's coming at us 24/7. The only way to resist it is to be able to see it and think it through. So to deny it is not going to help you.
This equity council at Evergreen sponsored lectures. They tried to educate students and faculty on how to detect all the racism that was going on. Well, guess what? They found lots of racism, lots and lots of racism. The harder they looked, the more they found. In fact, they managed to arrive at the conclusion that this college, the Evergreen State College, one of the most liberal institutions in the country, about the closest you could get to the liberal utopia they're trying to create, this college was actually a hive of white supremacy. And it was systematically destroying people of color, and it had been doing this for decades. Now, when you get someone that drunk on grievance politics, and their thinking becomes that perverse, you can be sure it's going to manifest itself in some ugly ways. How do you respond to that? If you are there at an institution that is systematically destroying people who look like you because of your skin color, then what are you supposed to do about that? Here's one lecturer explaining what they should do about these injustices.
So I offer three very different strategies, right? One is political organizing. Another one is non-traditional, maybe, you know, more resistance, more violent kind of action, and also prayer. Three different political strategies.
So this is the type of education these students were receiving. They were educated to be radical and even violent. I'm going to give you a short clip from one of the faculty at the Evergreen State College. This is a black faculty member named Naima Lowe.
The people who fought for our freedom were not cops or wealthy white city officials or gun-toting libertarians or glad-handing politicians looking to get our votes. They were hustlers, injection drug users, people who lived on the streets. They were black and brown queens and trans women who did not have the option to decide that their struggles were just about gay rights. The people who fought for our freedom took care of each other, creating safe places to be themselves.
So Professor Weinstein was very concerned about the direction that the college was taking. He was very concerned about the equity council and what they were suggesting and what they were encouraging people and what they were forcing on people. And he described one staff meeting where he had a confrontation with Ms. Lowe, this other faculty member. Here's how he explained what happened.
We were discussing the question. There were all these allegations about white supremacy at Evergreen, and every so often somebody, sometimes it was me, sometimes it was somebody else, asked about, okay, where's this white supremacy? Can we see it? Can we evaluate it? And this faculty member said that she said to ask students who are suffering from white supremacy to tell us about the instances of white supremacy is itself racism. And she said, we must stop asking them because we are inflicting harm on them asking for evidence. And the phrase she used, she said, to ask for evidence of racism is racism with a capital R.
2 years ago in March, racial minorities on campus made a shocking request. They wanted a day in which, in the words of the student newspaper, the Cooper Point Journal, quote, all white faculty and students remain absent from campus, leaving the space free for community members of color. Professor Brett Weinstein wrote an email to the faculty director of First Peoples Multicultural Advising Services, calling this demand an act of oppression. He refused to leave campus for being white. Word got out, and soon after, a mob of about 50 angry students besieged Weinstein and shouted obscenities at him every time he tried to explain himself. Someone called the police, but students blocked officers from entering the building. So when police found another way in, the students left and they went after the college president. Weinstein ended up having to hold his class off campus because police couldn't guarantee his safety. The president, President Bridges agreed to a meeting with the protesters later that day. And video emerged online of that raucous meeting. I can't even play clips because it is so full of profanity. These students are behaving like barbarians. They are insulting the president, insulting the faculty, insulting white people, showing unbridled emotion and anger and hatred. Anytime somebody tries to reason with them, they shout them down, they scream at them. It's all very emotional. It's not discussion. This is dogma. This is like religion, but without morals. So it gives rise to very thuggish, very bullying behavior. After the meeting, a coalition of black students issued a set of demands. And among their demands was one that the video of the event be taken down. They said it had been stolen by white supremacists and edited to expose and ridicule the students and staff. Other demands were that they disarm the campus police, that certain faculty members, including Weinstein, would be fired or suspended. They wanted mandatory sensitivity and cultural competency training for faculty, staff, administrators, and student employees, permanent hiring of a trans and queer center coordinator, the creation of a permanent position that will support undocumented students. Just radical, radical demands. And the college president agreed to some of these things. He offered a sort of a half-hearted defense of free speech. But then when one of the students told him to get rid of some of the teachers, this is what President Bridges said.
They're going to say some things that we don't like, and our job is to bring them on.
Mm-hmm.
Or get them out.
Right.
And what I hear us stating that we are working toward is bring them in, train them, and if they don't get it, sanction.
Bring them in, train them, and if they don't get it, sanction them. That is political re-education, and if that fails, punishment. That is authoritarianism, pure and simple. Now, this documentary shows how the faculty went along with what was going on. They apologized repeatedly and kowtowed to these students. They said the students were absolutely right and just in making these demands. It shows how the students took over the campus. At one point, they were stopping cars coming in and out of campus, apparently looking for Brett Weinstein. And he rode his bike to campus to teach that day. He was told that he was not safe on campus or off, that he should go home, that he should get in his car to have at least some protection in case the mob caught up to him. That was what the law enforcement officials told him. What was Brett Weinstein's crime? It was simply disagreeing with the methods that these people were using to instill this racial justice on the campus. And they wanted to do violence against him because in their minds, he came to embody the racism that they had become convinced was endangering their lives. It just makes zero sense. The Evergreen State College became an asylum run by the inmates. And this is emblematic of and just the advance guard of what is happening across the nation on our college campuses and university campuses. This is a trend that the Trumpet has been tracking for some years, but now it is becoming more emotional and animated by the spirit of the mob. It's becoming more violent. It's something that we have to watch very closely. This movement, this angry movement within America's universities shows the extremes to which the intolerance of the radical left is going. This is toxic behavior that it's seeping beyond these campuses. Really, it's affecting high schools, it's affecting middle schools. This type of thinking is even affecting elementaries. It's transforming America's workplaces and other places in the private sector. And when you appease it, it fuels it. And there's a lot of appeasing going on. There's a lot of people apologizing and kowtowing to this movement. And surely in places there are going to be backlashes, and that's going to add additional fuel to what is really a raging fire. And there are bound to be some of those as well. But this is a demonstration of the pillars of American society crumbling, coming under determined attack. This trend on our college campuses is one we should all be concerned about. We're already seeing it spread into our politics, and it gives a good look at where the policies that these folks propose to solve the nation's problems with, how they lead to problems and crises that are many, many times worse. I'll just conclude by playing this clip from this documentary. This is Brett Weinstein speaking.
I have to say, I keep being invited to talk about free speech on college campuses. And every time I'm invited, I make the same point, which is this isn't about free speech, and this is only tangentially about college campuses. This is about a breakdown in the basic logic of civilization, and it's spreading. And college campuses may be the first dramatic battle, but of course this is going to find its way into the courts. It's already found its way into the tech sector. It's going to find its way to the highest levels of governance if we're not careful, and it actually does jeopardize the ability of civilization to continue to function.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The United States is sending an aircraft carrier to the Persian Gulf in response to threats from Iran. Some American media outlets are criticizing the move for being unnecessarily provocative, as we will hear in this report from Brenton Octagall.
Right now, one of the most potent displays of U.S. military power is on the move. An aircraft carrier strike group led by the USS Abraham Lincoln headed to or near the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, it's in what the White House is calling a clear and unmistakable message to the Iranian regime. National Security Advisor John Bolton says, quote, any attack on the United States' interests or on those of our allies will be met with unrelenting force. Our Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr is all over this, along with our...
In response to a number of troubling and escalatory indications and warnings, the United States is deploying the USS Abraham Lincoln Carrier Strike Group and a bomber task force to the U.S. Central Command region to send a clear and unmistakable message to the Iranian regime that any attack on United States' interests or on those of our allies will be met with unrelenting force. The United States is not seeking war with the Iranian regime, but we are fully prepared to respond to any attack, whether by proxy, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or regular Iranian forces. That was a statement from National Security Advisor Ambassador John Bolton, and he was announcing that the United States now sees a credible threat against U.S. forces or forces of United States allies in the Persian Gulf. And in response, they are sending the Abraham Lincoln and the strike group attached to it to the Middle East. In reality, the carrier group of the Abraham Lincoln was already in the Mediterranean and was due to get to the Persian Gulf in 2 weeks. Instead, it's now going to head straight to the Persian Gulf. For years, the United States maintained a carrier presence in the Persian Gulf and the Middle East region. During the height of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there were two carriers in the area, but that was reduced to one. Last year, the administration of Mr. Trump decided to end the continuous carrier presence and send a strike group only intermittently into the region. The U.S. Navy currently has no aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, and so the sending of the carrier group is really just a reinstatement of the status quo that's existed for decades. What caused the current acceleration of the deployment, though? Some news sites would have you believe that it was simply an act of American aggression against Iran. But is that true? The news site Axios revealed that Israeli intelligence tipped off the United States a couple of weeks ago that Iranian proxies were planning an attack on United States forces or allied forces in the Gulf. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that these actions to bring the carrier strike group to the Persian Gulf early have been in the works for a while. It is absolutely the case that we have seen escalatory actions from the Iranians, and it's equally the case that we will hold the Iranians accountable for attacks on American interests, Mr. Pompeo said. If these actions take place, if they do by some third-party proxy or militia group like Hezbollah, we will hold the Iranian leadership directly accountable for that. Pompeo was then asked about the escalatory actions, and he replied, I don't want to talk about what underlays it, but make no mistake, we have good reason to want to communicate clearly about how the Iranians should understand how we will respond to any actions they might take. And so, what seems to be an understandable reaction to a threat of violence, the redeployment of a carrier group to the Gulf, which has been the status quo for the past two decades, now turns into an international event of a belligerent and warmongering America driving to war with Iran. On May 6, Politico headlined with this piece, "Trump inches toward military confrontation with Iran." In the article, it said this, "Taken together, Trump's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic and its latest attempt at gunboat diplomacy may be reaching a hazardous crescendo." Then it quotes Alex Vatanka, a senior fellow at a Middle East institute, saying this, quote, "I don't think either side wants to go to war, but this is the kind of brinkmanship that could get out of hand." The New York Times also headlined with similar sentiment as Politico. They had a piece entitled, "New Tensions with Iran Threaten Nuclear Deal and White House Says U.S. Troops." In the article, it says this, "Tensions escalated between the United States and Iran on Monday as the Trump administration accused Iran and militias that it backs of threatening American troops, and Iran signaled it might soon violate part of the 2015 nuclear deal it reached under former President Obama." Later, it says this, "Taken together, the moves by both sides have brought relations between President Trump and Iran to a new low after a period of rapprochement that began in 2013 with the Obama administration." As the New York Times would like you to believe, life was good with President Obama and the Iranian regime. While it is true that there were better relations between the Iranian regime and the United States under President Obama, it is also true that the nuclear deal flushed Iran with billions of US dollars to increase Iran's pushy foreign policy across the Middle East, funding proxies in Lebanon, Gaza, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. But the New York Times won't talk about that. They go on to write this, "The Trump administration has consistently sought to isolate Iran's clerical government. 1 year ago, Mr. Trump withdrew the United States from the nuclear deal that was brokered with world powers, and last month alone moved to cut off Iran's remaining oil exports and designated an Iranian military unit as a terror organization. Iran's expected suspension of some elements of the nuclear deal appeared to be a response to the aggressive American policies," which were underscored by the announcement of the USS Abraham Lincoln heading to the Gulf. See, to the New York Times, it's America that is aggressive, not the clerical regime in Iran, who, as recently as last week, told Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he should learn to swim because he's about to be pushed into the Mediterranean. No, not to the New York Times and others, it's the United States that's the aggressor in the Middle East. Then the New York Times wrote this, "The sanctions on Iran's oil exports were escalated 2 weeks after the country's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps was placed on the State Department's list of foreign terrorist organizations, the first time the designation was given to an arm of another nation's government. American intelligence and Defense Department officials had opposed the terror designation, concerned that Iran would similarly target or attack American troops and intelligence operatives in the region. Last week, President Hassan Rouhani of Iran declared all American forces in the Middle East as terrorists and labeled the United States government as a state sponsor of terrorism." And so, for the New York Times again, it's the United States that's the aggressor and started all of this going haywire. They designated part of the Iranian military as a terrorist organization. Defense officials warned the government that Iran might retaliate. And lo and behold, we see that Iran is planning to retaliate. And so, if only the State Department didn't designate them as a terrorist organization, we would not have come to this. Again, it's Mr. Trump's fault. What the New York Times failed to address was whether the IRGC is actually a terrorist organization, which they are. They fund, direct, weaponize Hezbollah, which kills Americans through terrorism. They also fund, direct, and weaponize Iraqi militias, which have caused 603 U.S. deaths in the Iraq War. And so, in reality, it's not the United States that's being aggressive. It is the United States that's finally saying, no, Iran. You cannot terrorize other nations anymore, and we are bringing a carrier back to where it used to be to show you that you aren't going to get away with doing it to our allies. It's the restoring of American deterrence against the march of Iranian-led radical Islam across the Middle East. But that's not what is reported in the New York Times. Towards the end of the article, they said this, John R. Bolton, the White House National Security Advisor, said in a statement on Sunday night that deploying the aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the Persian Gulf was intended to warn Iran that the United States would respond forcibly to any aggression against American forces or interests in the region. But, the New York Times writes, memories of the Iraq War and Mr. Bolton's own long history of harsh rhetoric on Iran have left administration officials under pressure to produce evidence of the imminent threat. By late Monday, no one in the Trump administration had stepped forward to make a specific case. And so the New York Times here is actually implying that the Trump administration is making it all up. There is no Iranian threat to the United States or its allies. Trump and his cabal of foreign policy hawks want a war with Iran, and so they're making up threats to position themselves to strike. Who would have thought that the New York Times would side with Iran over the United States? There is an age-old saying that when the cat goes away, the mice come out to play. Really, a show of American strength has proven to be the only deterrence against Iran's aggressive behavior in the region. And that's why the United States is moving its carrier group back to the Persian Gulf. Mark Dubowitz, who studies Iran for the Washington-based Policy Institute Foundation for Defense of Democracies, said, quote, "If past is prologue, the regime will always move aggressively forward when it senses American weakness and recoil when it sensed American strength." Is the United States really steering the region towards war? The New York Times and others might want you to believe so. But just as it peddles that narrative, it is actually downplaying the real aggressor in the region, the Iranian regime. In saying this, though, the New York Times is not just going against facts, it's also countering what the Bible says of the Iranian regime.
Thanks very much for that, Brent. You know, it is quite remarkable that the American media are taking Iran's side here. The evidence of what Iran is up to is quite strong. You were just in Ashkelon. You saw firsthand bombs going off, terrorist groups launching missiles. The Israelis say that Iran is behind that. There's a lot of evidence that Iran is funding those groups, if not giving orders for those groups. Maybe you could just talk about that and some of the evidence of Iranian aggression.
Yeah, it is really interesting to see so many Western media outlets that are pushing this narrative that Iran is not the aggressor in the Middle East, when Israel, of course, receives a lot of evidence almost daily that Iran is pushing the Israeli state towards war so often. And just this week, there's a huge flare-up on the Gaza border. 690 rockets were fired towards Israel on Sunday and Monday. And I was down there in Ashkelon seeing, you know, visiting a man's house that where he was just killed the day before from a rocket that was made either in Iran and shipped to the Gaza region, or it was made in Gaza with Iranian cash, or paid for by Iranian cash. It was a Palestinian Islamic Jihad missile. They are funded, directed, weaponized by Iran. They say it as much. They're even more in Iran's pocket than Hamas is in Iran's pocket. And so to say that Iran isn't causing destruction of American allies on a weekly basis in the Middle East is an outright lie. I had to run to cover by an Iranian-made, Iranian-paid-for missile on Sunday. And so there's plenty of evidence out there. And nobody can really deny that Iran is supporting these groups and directing them, though even that gets failed to be mentioned quite a lot. I mean, Drudge Report over the weekend had that on one of the top headlines saying Iran's fingerprints are over this. And that was good to see, because you read more of the Western outlets reporting on the Gaza-Israeli war and it's Hamas or the Palestinians against Israel, and they forget that this is a front on the Iranian war, just another front of the Iranian war against the state of Israel.
Yeah, and I think you did a good job of bringing out in your report, too, the fact that the New York Times is inherently skeptical of the claims of the Trump administration, and you would say the same thing about the claims of the Israeli government, and yet the evidence of Iranian duplicity is just outrageous and massive, that there's been time after time where Iran has been trying to cover its tracks for activity that was illegal or that it was insisting publicly that it wasn't involved in. Why aren't they more skeptical of what's coming out of Iran?
Yeah, why are they such saying this? I mean, this really goes back to the love affair that they had with the Obama administration, and this was the number one foreign policy goal of the Obama administration: bring the Islamic world in, make friends with the Iranians at any cost, allow the Iranians to do whatever they want in the Middle East, furnish them with $150 billion worth of cash, sign a nuclear deal with them that eventually allows them to actually get the bomb in 10 years. Which is only, you know, we're already halfway there if the nuclear deal was almost halfway there if the nuclear deal was still in effect. And so that the Western media bought into that hook, line, and sinker. They loved it. They loved that narrative. They loved the Ben Rhodes narrative. That was it. That this is a wonderful deal for the world. And congratulations to President Obama. You brought Iran in from the cold. They're going to be just like everybody else.
Yeah, and in spite of all of the deceit that was required for that deal to go through, you still have the New York Times saying that these latest escalations represent a step backward in the progress that the Obama administration had made in our diplomacy with Iran. It's quite extraordinary. So there at the end of your piece, you mentioned the fact that not only is the New York Times and other observers ignoring the evidence, but they're also going against what prophecy says. It doesn't take tremendous insight to see Iran's aggressiveness, but let's talk about prophecy. What does that say about it?
Yeah, this is very important, an important point of why we're covering it, because the Bible has the absolute opposite opinion to the New York Times. The Bible says in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 that there is going to be this king of the south in the time of the end, that's a king of the south that we've talked about being an editor-in-chief, has written about for 30 years, being radical Islam led by Iran, the nation of Iran, pushing the Middle East towards war. That's what it says there in verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall push against the king of the north. And so the Bible says that this radical Islamic empire or kingdom is the belligerent actor, is the aggressor. It is actually the number one characteristic that the Bible gives Iran. And so here you have Western media outlets, the Obama administration, and everyone that want to peddle this lie that Iran is nothing of the sort, and it's going against what the Bible says. And so if we're going to be looking at world events, hoping to allow world events to furnish Bible prophecy or to show us where we are in Bible prophecy, one of the key elements we need to look for is a pushy Iranian nation. And we have the Western media trying to shut that narrative down, not even a narrative, that pit of truth down, and blunt the sword of biblical prophecy. And so this can be quite frustrating as we're trying to get people to be urgent about their lives and urgent about the fulfillment of Bible prophecy when you have all of their news outlets that they get, the mainstream media that wants to downplay Iran's aggression.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do appreciate that, Brent. We've been talking to trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about America's moves to curb Iran's terrorist activity. He's working on an article for thetrumpet.com on this subject. You can watch the front page for that. In the meantime, go check out the article he wrote earlier this week. He sent it out in the Trumpet Brief on Monday. It's called Why Can't Israel Solve the Gaza Crisis? He also recorded a Watch Jerusalem podcast, and that's embedded within that article. And it has just a much more detail about his experience there in Ashkelon earlier in the week, and even some sound clips of that harrowing experience. And so definitely worth checking out. You can see that on the front page of thetrumpet.com. Brent, we really appreciate your time.
No problem.
It's time for today's last word.
What do you do when your children won't listen to you? Many parents admit they don't know, and they find their methods for disciplining their children don't work. You see these parents all the time at the local grocery. Their repeated threats, if you do that one more time, did you hear me? For the last time, stop it. They don't work. They float and pop like tiny bubbles. Many of these parents have just given up, and they leave their children in charge. Why don't their methods of discipline work? You know, after timeouts and removing privileges, the third most common form of discipline, according to a clinical pediatrics survey, is yelling at the child. Now, that's a sign of parents who never taught their children to listen. Parents who punish only when their children get on their nerves. Well, they've fallen into one of the easiest parenting traps: lack of consistency and follow-through. The Plain Truth About Child Rearing, this was a booklet put out by the Worldwide Church of God under Herbert W. Armstrong, calls this perhaps the most common of all parental failings in administering just and loving discipline. It says to punish for an infraction one day and then to allow the same infraction without punishment the next day is totally confusing to a child. Frequently, parents will say, "But I do spank him," and then go on to argue, "But it doesn't do a bit of good." Always at the root of a statement like that is discipline that is totally ineffective because it is not being done consistently. Now, this is an easy trap to fall into when we get too focused on ourselves. We give a command, we fail to notice whether the child obeys, for example. We can make excuses for our children. We can have fuzzy expectations and then fail to recognize rebellion for what it really is. Now, this is an especially bad problem in a society that is suspicious of or ambivalent about authority and discipline. So parents second-guess themselves. Every time the child defies them, they're in a quandary because they don't want to confront the child. Well, it's critical that we teach our children to listen carefully and obey our instructions promptly and specifically. The only way to teach this is by speaking only once and then disciplining the child who fails to obey. Check up on yourself. Give your child a single simple command and see how he or she responds. We are to emulate God as a parent. The Bible has a lot of powerful examples of how consistent God is in disciplining his children when necessary. One of the clearest is the case of Uzzah. King David was moved to reclaim the Ark of the Covenant from the Philistines and transport it back to Jerusalem. That was a noble goal, and God backed that. The problem was God had clearly demanded that this holy object be handled in a certain way, and David treated those demands casually. God had instructed that the ark was to be carried only by the Levitical sons of Kohath. David gave the job to a couple of non-priests, including Uzzah. Well, God wanted the ark borne on the priest's shoulders, and he wanted it touched only by the staves that extended through the rings on the ark. Well, David put it on a cart. It was to be covered with badger skins, and that might not have been done in this case. And God warned that if the ark was ever touched, the offender would die. You can find all of that in the scriptures. But when David transported the ark, he didn't even talk to God about it. He consulted with the people, and they assured him everything would be all right. But it wasn't right. In fact, David was being very sloppy with God's law. The oxen carrying the cart stumbled. The ark became unsteady. Uzzah reached out to secure it, and the moment he touched it, he died, just like God said would happen. Now, if God were like most parents today, he would have reasoned, well, you know, that was an honest mistake. I'll overlook it this time. I'll give him another warning. You know, actually, maybe I shouldn't have made that law in the first place. But God didn't do any of those things. He had spelled out the law and the penalty for its infraction. He spoke once, and he followed through. And look at the effect that this rebuke from God had on King David and on the Israelites. It was shocking. First, David became angry, which shows that his thinking really was off at the time. But after he reflected on it, he repented. And then he finished the job correctly. He took very special precautions to do it precisely according to God's original instructions. God's firmness prevented David's disobedience from getting any worse, and it set the nation back on course. Now, this incident beautifully illustrates what the Apostle Paul wrote in Hebrews 12 and verse 11. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. Later, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. That's what the Revised Standard Version says in that verse. So, parents, follow God's example. Be clear about the rules. Speak only once and expect your children to obey. Then pay attention. And when they go off course, don't make excuses for them. Be consistent about applying the necessary discipline. If you do, you'll find that the battles between you and your children will subside. You and your children will both experience the peaceable fruit that only results from the godly application of consistent, loving correction. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guest, Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from Daniel O'Connell. Nothing is politically right which is morally wrong. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.